You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Tuesday, 4 August. We've got U.S. trade balance data due this afternoon. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Gauteng, Johannesburg. On the show today, Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss. We're about two-thirds of the way into U.S. earnings season. I'm curious, what's the standout for Gary, a good or a bad? We chat with Sela Sekela from Absa CIB. That July PMI data, it went down, but maybe it's not all bad news. We pull that apart, and then we'll chat with Old Mutual Wealth Fund, doing offshore diversification right. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, while Coronation has added Absa to flagship fund. While the market remains cautious, it's backing the new CEO to turn the business around. And from business day, Metair completes turnaround as earnings recover despite weak vehicle production. Manufacturers' aftermarket business is recovering, led by AutoZone. Morning markets, US was green, S&P 1.5% higher. That is an all-time high close. NASDAQ up 1.8%. The East, mostly red. Sydney's up just over 1%. Tokyo's down 0.2%. Hong Kong almost 0.5% down, and Tencent exactly 0.5% lower. Commodities mostly green. Gold futures 4,113. Brent 84.82. Platinum 1,666. And palladium is the red at 1,280. Rand is 16.51. Bitcoin 63,800. And top 40 opening call, green open expected, 190 points or little under 0.2% higher.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting over with Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss. Gary, always appreciate the early morning time. Coming into this Q2 earnings season for the U.S., I mean, expectations were high. The market wanted a lot from this. My sense is looking, we're about two-thirds of the way through, is that expectations have been, I don't know, smashed. I mean, the numbers coming through are looking really, really strong. Interesting chart I saw yesterday, margins of S&P 500, record highs. For you, what's been a standout of this earnings season?
Yeah, so it has been a spectacular earnings season. I think coming into it, looking at the expectations, there was always the fear that you're going to see what happened with Samsung, that they might even match those expectations. But if they didn't beat those expectations significantly, you'd see severe stock price declines. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been incredibly benign. So, call it 60% of the way through the season. We've got 86% of S&P 500 companies have beaten earnings and 77% have beaten revenue. So, I mean, that's significant. If you actually look at the year-on-year growth, 47% higher. Now that is just a staggering number when you consider it. So if you look back, the only really comparable lifts like this has been the second quarter of 2021, which was up 91%. But that obviously had the COVID base effect and it's skewing it massively. So we shut down a whole lot of companies, reopened them, and then got a massive earnings lift. And this is very different. And if you go back before that, you're really talking about the fourth quarter of 2009, which had the GFC devastation in it. And we're not coming out of a crisis. This is actual just growth from what is a very exciting sector. But the 47% number is exceptionally high, and it is a bit of a caveat to that as well. So if you look into that, you'll see that Alphabet booked about $100 billion in investment gains, largely because of SpaceX. Amazon also booked $53 billion non-operating income, mainly because of Anthropic. So if you strip those two out, it's not 47% higher. It's about a 29% lift. But even that is still massively high. And this is really the CapEx boom filtering into the rest of the economy.
I was going to say, I mean, this sounds like, and I appreciate taking out the SpaceX and Anthropic, and that's an absolute fair shot. It still leaves us with a giant number, of course. I mean, is this just the AI, which is more than, 3 years ago, AI was all about NVIDIA chips, but now it's those data centers which need, I don't know, they need steel, they need aircon, they need power, all sorts of things. I mean, is it still just the AI trade sort of broadening out, or is it sort of narrow in the sense of maybe it's just memory or semis?
Yeah, so that's, I mean, it's a great point. Now, I think that the story has shifted a little bit. And where we've seen the significant growth coming through is actually from the hyperscalers. So if you look at Microsoft, for example, their Azure business growing 43%, well ahead of expectations. You look at Amazon, AWS, their growth 37%, strongest in 4 years, boosted the shares up 14%. So I think what this earnings season is telling us is that the AI spending, specifically from the hyperscalers, will be tolerated. As long as you can convert that CapEx into revenue, then you win. If you ask shareholders to wait, then you lose. And we saw it also in the broader sector as well. You look at the disappointing results from Apple. I mean, shares were down 10%, and that was largely because the AI components that are going into these data centers that are being built are literally the supply is being constrained, and it's boosting up costs for iPhones and Macs, and that's not a good thing. So it's a hyperscalers, which I think were a lot of people had concerns around, did exceptionally well. You talked about the semis. I mean, their earning lift was absolutely spectacular. I mean, up 135%. But the share price reactions were actually disappointing. So you look at the Microns, the SK Hynixes, their share prices have come off, but it was just because there was so much excitement baked into that. And that's unwinding a little bit. But yeah, broadly speaking, this is filtering into the rest of the economy as well. So if we look at the S&P subsectors, 10 out of 11 subsectors showed earnings growth. The only one that declined was healthcare. And even that, if you exclude the R&D spend from Gilead and Merck, which really impacted it, it would have been positive as well. You look at the financials, you look at how the banks came out. Banks absolutely killed it. So this is kind of a broad win. And I think a lot of the concerns around growth and overspending is maybe a little bit more muted. And I think, one other point that I picked up as well, just kind of going through the earnings analysis. The interesting part is if you strip out S&P 500 companies that have more than 50% of their revenue in the U.S. versus the international markets, S&P companies that are more broadly exposed to the global economy, they had an earnings lift of 74% versus S&P companies that are more domestically focused, only 35%. So this whole idea of America first, deglobalization, it's not coming through in these earnings numbers, and these multinational companies are really doing well.
All for us, it seems just that no one cares. Absolutely no one seems to. We all worry about it. We clutch our pearls, but the market storms on, and more importantly, the profits absolutely storms on. Expectations were massive, and it's been an absolutely insane earnings season. We'll leave it there. Gary Boyson, Rand Swiss, always appreciate the early morning time. Give your money the return at once without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Solo Sekele. He's from Absa CIB. Solo, appreciate the time. The seasonally adjusted Absa Purchasing Managers Index, PMI data out. We got 46.8 in July. That's down from 47.3. But in the release, accompanying the numbers, the concept perhaps not an overstating weakness in the underlying manufacturing condition. Talk me through the fact that this number might not be as bad as it seems on the surface.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So I want to say that this PMI release is quite interesting. So a decline this time around hides more positive things than it reveals. So firstly, the PMI declined because of inventories as well as supply delivery times. So for supply delivery times, the decline is quite welcome this time around. And we think that the decline is showing us that supply chain disruptions are easing, because recently we've seen a situation where supply delivery times are increasing even when activity is weakening. So that's a positive. And then two other positive things to highlight is that new sales orders improved, and they improved at the back of domestic demand. And we also saw, as a result of demand improving, the business activity index also improving. So I think all in all, the underlying data of the PMI is quite positive. Also, if you take into account how the purchasing price index eased in July.
And you make the point around inventories, and it declined. But you also said in the press release,
it could be delaying purchases in anticipation of lower input costs. In other words, this is actually not around demand. This is just like, hey, it might be cheaper in a week or a month.
Yeah, so we think that it can be that, or it can be as a result of manufacturers not being convinced that this strong demand story, especially on the domestic side, might be sustained.
I get you. And we're simply not sure, but we'll get, you know, as we move on through the year. What we did see, very encouraging, purchasing price index coming down in July. This kind of suggests that the oil price shock and fuel price shocks have largely moved through the system. We are not back where we were in February, but the worst is definitely behind us. And the data here confirms that.
I think so too. I think that's how manufacturers are interpreting it. Because if you look at, you know, the Brent crude oil price on a month-to-month basis, it didn't really move much. So I think, you know, they just think that the worst is past us, and hopefully the worst is past us. But as you did say, you know, in level terms, I mean, costs are nowhere near where we were pre the war period. But something to keep an eye on is the recent weakness in the rand. So if that continues, we might start to see this purchasing price index going forward start to rise again.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah, yeah, of course, of course. Employment, the one I always turn to, it ticked up from what, 41.4 to 42.2, still well off May. Employment, I mean, more broadly for our economy, employment remains a challenge, and this month's PMI kind of confirms that.
Yeah, it's quite encouraging to see the employment index tick up a bit, but it has ticked up to levels that are way below what we saw in May. And in fact, this index has been below 50 for some time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which suggests that employment in the sector has been quite subdued. So what will turn this employment index upwards? It will be, you know, sustained activity in the sector that will hopefully lead to more employment in the sector.
Yeah. And if I look at that, particularly the employment, what, maybe 10 times in the last decade, it's been above 50. It's been a continual. Last question, and certainly a piece of good news, is that the data is suggesting activity in Durban Port is definitely picking up. And Durban Port was a huge concern. And certainly there is a turnaround happening. It's slow, but it certainly is happening, which is good for the economy.
Yeah, it's good because, you know, our ports and our railway lines, or let me just say network industries in general, those have been a binding constraint on South Africa, right? So as that improves, then we will start to see the SA economy moving past the 1%, I will say, barrier for now, because it feels like it. So as soon as our logistics sector gets better, that's when we'll start to see GDP improving quite a bit, provided that, you know, structural reforms elsewhere are also progressing. But what I want to say is that we need to be cautiously optimistic because, yes, the Durban port is improving, but the Cape Town one seems to be lagging. When you look at anecdotal reports, for example, in newspapers, you'll see that some of the farmers, you know, are diverting their exports from the Cape Town port to elsewhere. So that's one to keep an eye on. And this port for some time has been ranked very bad in terms of the World Bank rating. So yes, optimism, but cautious optimism.
I get your point. And I mean, ports infrastructure is such a bottleneck that needs to be resolved. And then we can start looking at that 1% GDP. We'll leave it there. That's Celis Sekela. He's Absa CIB. Appreciate the time.
The Standard Flexible Income Fund delivers capital preservation and consistent top quartile inflation beating returns. Let your money keep working with Stanlib Asset Management even after you retire.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting with Francis Murray, Head of Investment and Fund Solutions at Old Mutual Wealth. Francis, appreciate the time. Oftentimes when we're thinking about diversification, in a recent note you put out, we're actually just responding to market events. Iran weakens, a booming US tech, and we're suddenly rushing offshore. We're more doing a FOMO trade, and we're often late to the party rather than good old-fashioned proper diversification.
Exactly. Yeah. Good morning, Simon, and good morning to the listeners. That's exactly right. So what we are saying is that when investing offshore, be very careful of thinking about it as a once-off event, you should really be looking at it from an holistic financial planning perspective. And once you start doing that, offshore investing becomes more a consistent practice. It certainly shouldn't be one where you invest offshore because you've missed out on good returns because of the AI trade, for instance. So that's a FOMO that you're referring to. But it should also not be done because the Rand is suddenly depreciated quite a lot and you are scared and then you decide to go offshore. So it should be part of a holistic plan and it should be something that you consider on an ongoing basis.
That's a great point. And, you know, it's my strategy is always, you know, regularly there's money going offshore. That's just part of that process. And it's not about even about returns. It's about diversification. It's about broader range of options.
Absolutely. So, I mean, in South Africa, we obviously have a very well-developed financial services industry, and we have quite, you know, a lot of good companies and businesses, but it's only really a subset. And if you look at the industries, it's really financials and resources, right?
Yeah,
so if you go offshore, you gain exposure to, you know, a variety of different sectors. I've mentioned already one, sort of artificial intelligence, but also biotechnology, pharmaceuticals, etc. So we are definitely not saying avoid South Africa. We are saying expose yourself to different types of companies operating in different industries that will have different type of income streams. It's really to complement what you're already doing from an investment perspective.
And when you mention income streams, my sense is, and I'm 100% guilty of this, when I think offshore, I think equities. And I kind of stop at that point. And of course, there is a whole world and, you know, not even the exotics. I mean, just fixed income. I mean, yeah, there are funds out there that can get me, what, 3.5-4% in US dollar, which I think we far too often overlook.
That's correct. So what I'm also saying is that when you are looking and considering diversification, remember that valuations do matter. The more expensive asset classes are, the less value they add to diversification. And we've seen this for a while now and globally, people avoiding fixed income assets. People tend to, yes, as you say, invest more in equities when they do go offshore. And I think there's a rational reason for that.
Sure.
One is that your time horizon tends to be a lot longer. So equities are obviously a natural fit for that. But with valuations and interest rates at least sort of normalizing in developed markets, I think there might be an argument to be made to also consider fixed income investments more generally these days. But with a caveat, you know, valuations do matter. And consider that when you are considering diversification.
That's a good point, because it really is. It's about diversification is about resilience. It's not about that maximizing returns. It's about accepting that we don't know what's going to happen, you know, next week, next month, heck, next decade. It's about building that resilience into a portfolio.
Yeah, so if you want to be naughty, you could argue that diversification is actually a very inefficient strategy with a caveat or the qualification if you had perfect foresight, right?
Yeah,
in the absence of perfect foresight, diversification is a very efficient way of investing. Yes, it does mean you're giving up sort of absolute returns at the expense of absolute returns, but you are creating more resilient risk-adjusted returns. One never knows what happens in the future. People might say, listen, I'm convinced that equities will always outperform. And so that might be a very valid point. But even in that scenario, you never know what lies in future, what might be your future liquidity requirements. So diversification actually always makes sense from that perspective.
Yeah, I take your point. If we know the future, it's easy. We just all go back and buy what NVIDIA 10 years ago and we locked and loaded.
Exactly.
But it wasn't that simple 10 years ago. Here's my really, really hard question. We're talking offshore, and I suspect many of us are probably light on offshore because we're so South Africa. Our jobs are here. Our families are here. Our house is here. We've got so much in the SA environment. Is there a perfect number to how much we have offshore? Is it more a case of that process, that consistency you mentioned up at the top?
I think it's really important to, first of all, have a financial plan in place, and that you can do with your intermediary. And secondly, it's very important to understand what your future goals are, what your family's goals are, where your children are going to study, what you will be doing when you're retiring.
Okay.
So this number is really a very personal number. And what we are saying is be aware of what that is and then invest accordingly. But don't try and avoid it, or don't try and go offshore just because you are missing out on returns or you're scared about the currency.
I get your point. And part of it is, what is my rand needs? As you were saying there, if I've got, you know, kids are going to be going studying overseas, I need dollars. If they're going to be studying local, I need ZAR. And that's making it a little bit binary, but that's kind of the conversations to be having.
Absolutely. Remember, I mean, even if you have liabilities in ZAR, I mean, it's a good idea to have some assets exposed to offshore. But absolutely to your point, if you are going to have still children going offshore or are going to have needs that you want to sort of finance in the future from an offshore perspective, you definitely need to have offshore assets.
We'll leave it there. Francis Murray, he's Head of Investment and Fund Solutions, Ord Mutual Wealth. Appreciate the time. And that's our poll today on LinkedIn. How well diversified is your portfolio? I mean, is it all, I don't know, NVIDIA? In which case, to be clear, you've done great. High risk, but done great. Well diversified, not really. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn. That's it for today. Yesterday we were chatting with Pierre-Thierry Radenhaes. He, of course, from Hirenia Capital Advisors. We're talking Anglo Gold Ashanti results, but gold miners more generally, and asking if you were buying gold miners as gold trades around that $4,000, $4,100 level. Almost half of you said already holding. A third said, nope, not for you. The rest said, absolutely. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobukle, Nicole Sabut, to you for listening. My guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. The luxury of being 25.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.